I wonder how you feel about living in Britain today. I have to say, last week I was amongst many who were very disappointed. I thought that our Parliament last week showed that it had a scant regard for the dignity of human life. Our Parliament voted to maintain a level of limits for aborting children. So you have the nonsense that in one operating theatre a child is being aborted, and in another a surgeon is fighting to save its life, and they're exactly the same age. Last week our Parliament voted to allow parents to create saviour siblings who are basically children brought into the world in order to benefit somebody else. I thought that our nation had got rid of slavery 175 years ago, but apparently we've just reintroduced it. And our Parliament voted to introduce legislations which would permit embryos to be cultured simply for their stem cells to be harvested, despite the scientific data that says that not one single medical advance has been produced from any research on embryonic stem cells anywhere in the world, whereas adult stem cells are producing all kinds of advantages. I have to say, last week I was very, very angry, and I thought to myself, what an ungodly land that we live in today. We're beginning a series now on Daniel. It's going to take us the next few weeks up into the summer. And Daniel and his colleagues, his friends, the princes who came with him, and all those who came from Judah over came eastwards to Babylon were in exile. They were placed into a land that was ungodly. They were ruled over by people who did not acknowledge the Lord of the universe. Instead, they had their own gods who they worshipped in their own way. You might feel today in Britain that you are in exile, that where you are now as a Christian, though you live here, it is not in some senses your land. You are distance from it. The country does things and behaves in a way that seems to not just push God onto one side, but literally shove him out of the room. The experience of Daniel, as we read it over the next few weeks, will show us key insights in how we interact with such a world that we live in. If you went to Spring Harvest 3 years ago in 2005, you would have had that same series, Spring Harvest looked at Daniel and how we live as exiles in the world. I want to suggest that as we look again at this opening chapter, we're going to see some clear principles in how God calls us to interact as exiles in the world. So as David said at the start, the context of this reading is very clear. Jerusalem has fallen. The Babylonian Empire basically conquered left, right, and center. They took over huge swathes of the Middle East. And the Babylonian rulers had an ingenious way of getting rid of troublesome parts of their empire. They knew that some of the peoples would just get on with being ruled. They looked at Judah and the Jews. They looked at different people and they thought, you know what, they're going to be a pain in the backside. So what they did was they literally carted off all the leaders, all the important people. When the Nazis in late 30s and 40s, when Nazi Germany invaded Eastern Europe and then Western Europe and conquered nations, what they would do, they understood this principle. They literally had a big list of all the people, all the intelligentsia, all the rulers, all the judges, all the people who were in any way leaders in the country. And they literally, as soon as they got into the countries, they rounded them up and they carted them away. if you destroy the leadership, if you remove the people who might think and provoke and cause the people to rise up and respond, you eliminate any trouble. So that's what the Babylonians did. They literally took a whole swathe of the Jews and put them into exile. They brought them over to Babylon. And that's what Daniel was doing in Babylon. He was one of the princes. The Babylonians, however, weren't quite as brutal as the Nazis were, because they recognized that many of these people who they brought away from their people were very capable. And they wanted to assimilate them into their empire. They were the ultimate multiculturalists, as it were. But not really multiculturalism, it was monoculturalism. It was take this person, this person, this person, and turn them into Babylonians. So that's what was happening to Daniel. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, they're all carted off east. They're all made trainee civil servants. They're put onto the fast kind of track in modern civil servants parlance. I applied for the civil service fast track in this country. I never even got to the first round of interview. You read the Daily Mail, the Mail on Sunday this morning with the article about how the bishops think that half the clergy in Britain are useless. That probably explains why I'm here and not running the embassy in Moscow. So here they are. Daniel and his mates. They're Jews. They come from a time in the history of Judah where the formal Jewish religion is beginning to be established. They're being trained as Babylonian civil servants in an attempt from the Babylonians to assimilate them, to remove their culture, and to make them work for the empire that has conquered them. And that's fine, you know, it was good training. They learnt the language, the literature, you know, all these kind of things. Very, very useful. If a country conquers you, get to learn their language. It will help you get on. And then there's one teensy-weensy problem. Because they come to eat, and they find out that as trainee civil servants, they have been given a portion from the king's table. Now that's actually a grandiose term. It's not that the king had a big table and all the meat was put on it and he said, right, then give that bit to Daniel and give that bit to Mordecai and all that kind of stuff. It's an expression that they were fed out of the kitchen in the palace. They got the best food. The problem was, the best food was not kosher. The best food, the best meat, had been slaughtered in a way that for Jews would have meant that to eat it would have made them totally unclean in the eyes of God. So they're caught in a quandary. So far, they've accepted exile. They've accepted entrance onto the fast track of the Babylonian civil service. They've accepted weird clothes, probably. All the different cultural things. A strange land. But now they're being asked to eat meat. But if they eat it, it will defile them in front of God. Now, the response of Daniel is interesting. Have a look at it. It's on page 883 in the Bible. Some of you have already got it in front of you. Page 883. And in verse 9 and 10, you see, sorry, in verse 8, you see Daniel's response. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in this way. And then later on in verse 12, please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat, because that's all there was, apart from the meat and the wine. It was nothing but vegetables to eat. Frankly, if it had just been sprouts, I think he'd been onto a loser. But having eaten in the Middle East, vegetables are more than just sprouts, they're actually rather good. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. So what Daniel basically says is this. He doesn't say, don't feed us anything. Oh no, you're going to give us evil food. Don't feed us anything. Oh no, you're horrible, pagan people. Oh no, you're horrible. He doesn't say that. He says, don't give us the specific things that would offend us and would offend our God. Do you notice the subtle difference? He doesn't entirely disengage from everything. He simply disengages from the bit that causes the problem. He still gets the vegetables. They still came from the king's table, as it were. He just didn't eat the things that he would find unclean. And interestingly, he didn't actually need to tell the guard that. He could have just got his meat and his vegetables and so on and just have not eaten the meat. But he knows that the guard is responsible and the chief official is responsible to the king. He knows that there are relationships involved here. This is not just about him. This is not just about him and his relationship with God. It's about his friend, the guard. It's about his friend, the chief official. What will happen to them when Daniel stops eating meat? So he basically says, look, it's fine. We'll survive on corn burgers for 10 days. And then look at us afterwards and compare us to everybody else and see how we're doing. And the guard agrees. I suspect he agrees because they had a relationship. Because he knew Daniel not just as the Bolshy Jew in the corner, but as a friend. So the guard agrees. The guard takes a risk for his friend Daniel. He risks that Daniel and his friends will come out in 10 days looking the worse for the wear, and then the guard will cop it because he's responsible for feeding the men. Let's think for a moment then about this decision Daniel makes. Because sometimes I think we have a tendency as Christians to entirely remove ourselves from the world. We have a tendency not to engage with it. Now, the last film that I saw before my life changed forever was Son of Rambo. Who's seen Son of Rambo? None of you have seen Son of Rambo. Seriously. Okay, Son of Rambo is the best film this year so far. Like Enchanted was the best film last year. So Son of Rambo is... I can't believe none of you have seen it. Makes my whole anecdotal thing now going to have to work really hard to explain the whole film to you now. Son of Rambo, basically, the plot is this, okay? The plot involves a 12-year-old boy who comes from a Brethren family. Now, the Brethren are like an exclusive Protestant sect. I wouldn't say very, well, kind of legalistic, but very withdrawn, very concentrating on following God and following the precepts of Scripture and not letting themselves be influenced by the world. And this young boy, whose name I forget at the moment, he's not allowed to watch TV. So while the rest of his class in a geography lesson are watching some program about volcanoes and, you know, evil things that will corrupt their minds, like volcanoes, while the rest of the class are watching volcanoes and how they work and all that kind of stuff, he has to sit outside. And unfortunately for him, the kid sitting outside the classroom just up the corridor is not outside of the room for the same reason. His name is Lee Carter, and Lee Carter is the school miscreant. Lee Carter is a year older, and basically, if there's a kid who's going to get into trouble, it is Lee Carter. And events transpire, but we end up with them both at Lee Carter's home. Lee Carter lives in a nursing home owned by his parents who live in Spain, who never are there, and his brother is there, and it's a complicated family setup. And basically, Lee Carter is pirating videos for his older brother, who then sells them. And the video that he's pirating today is Rambo First Blood. Who's seen Rambo First Blood? Yeah, I see a few more honest things. Yeah, yeah. It's an okay movie, you know. It's an okay movie. Anyway, this kid accidentally sees Rambo First Blood, and he is inspired. I mean, he's always drawing and stuff like that stuff, but suddenly he is inspired. And what the kid and Lee Carter decide to do is to make a film to send into Screen Test. Who remembers Screen Test in the 1980s? Yeah, yeah. You could send in, you could make a film, send in a film, and then they, it was really cheesy. And they want to make a film, and it ends up involving everybody and the French exchange students and the French exchange student who all the French class hate actually turns out to be the really cool kid. And it's a great movie, Son of Rambo. Go and see it. It's great. The point is this. When his family find out not only that he's watched TV, but that he's watched Rambo, First Blood, when they find out that he's mixing with Lee Carter, you know, the 1980s school version of Adolf Hitler, not only that, he's making a film. He's not just watching TV, he's making a film. It makes a massive crisis in the family. Because the family are not meant to watch TV. They're not meant to engage in the world. They live in the world, but they're not meant to be part of the world. The choice that the family makes at that point is to choose between will they continue to disengage from the world or will they engage with it. I won't spoil the ending for you because it's brilliant. Go and see the film. The family in Son of Rambo come from a community that have chosen to, rightly or wrongly, disengage from the world. But Daniel, in our reading, is different. Daniel, instead of withdrawing from the world that he is in, and to be fair, he's got little choice about it. To be fair, if he said, you know what, I don't want to become a civil servant, let me just go back to Jerusalem, there'd be a nice guy with a big spear to go, hum, like that into him. So, he's got no choice. But instead of just disengaging, instead of withdrawing from the process that he's in, from the environment that he's found himself in, he asks the guard that they can be excused of things that are an absolute no-no. For a limited time, so that it can be seen whether they are necessary. And it's clear, he asks the guard to withdraw from these things for a limited time, 10 days, in order to see whether they are actually truly necessary. So what he's doing essentially is he's gently challenging the mindset and the worldview of the guard and the whole palace who think the food on the king's table is the best food. Compare this to the family in the film that simply disengage. It's not about we don't want to watch the wrong TV programs, you know? Because there are some TV programs that are great. There are some TV programs for which there is nothing wrong, aren't there? Do you want me to name one? You know it. There are some fine TV, there are plenty of awful TV programs. There's plenty of stuff I wouldn't want to watch, wouldn't want my son to watch, wouldn't want any of you to watch. There's plenty of good stuff. The family in the film entirely disengage from everything that is associated with some things that may corrupt. Daniel, for a limited time, disengages from one thing in order to test whether it will harm him or not harm him. And what happens? 10 days later, the official looks at Daniel. He sees that the choices that Daniel has made is not destructive, and he lets Daniel and his friends continue the diet that they are on. What then happens? God gives Daniel and his friends the gifts that they need. Gifts of knowledge and understanding, and Daniel in particular, gifts to interpret dreams. As we read on in Daniel, we'll see how they come useful. So how are we to make use of this today as the kids come and join us? How am I doing on time? Horribly. There we go. How are we to make use of this today? And now I say it, even though they seem to have vanished, how are the Chilano family? How are you? They've gone. My whole point of talking to them at this point, it's ruined. Well, you're there, aren't you? Yes. I saw I completely missed you there. You're there at the back. Hello, Andrew. Andrew, Hannah, Benjamin, how are you to live as exiles in the land today? How are you to raise Benjamin and Holly? And how are we to raise all our kids in a world that increasingly pushes Jesus out of the way? Well, the first thing that we need to do, I think, is to recognize that though we are in exile, this is nothing new. We can hark back to a fictitious golden age of virtue and holiness. But in reality, Christians and those who follow the God of the Bible have always been outsiders the moment that they actually stand up and practice what they believe. Thomas More, Henry VIII's Chancellor, got along happily, until the king asked him to fix a divorce, and he knew deep in his conscience that that divorce was ungodly. And he lost his job, and he lost his life. John Bunyan could have just happily joined the state church, done what the state church asked him to do, but instead he preached what he believed the scriptures were saying, and he ended up spending years in prison. William Wilberforce could have simply taken Pitt's offer of a cabinet job and gone on with being probably one of the greatest prime ministers this country had ever seen. But instead he chose that his commitment to Jesus and to remove slavery in this land was more important. And so he worked his entire life. He sacrificed his entire political career for it. We need to recognize that we are exiled in this land, and there is nothing new about that. If you think that we can go back to some kind of golden age when Christians were, everything was nice and happy and holy, you are wrong. Second thing that we need to do is we need to engage as much as possible with the world, not withdraw from it. The Bible says we are in the world but not of it. But sometimes we take that to mean not in the world and having no part of it. That's why for this church, being in the community is so important. That's why we have a community outreach worker, Alison Jackson, who does a fantastic job. That's why we do Love Where, Live Where. That's why we have a holiday club. That's why we have a lunch for people on Tuesdays. It's because we believe being part of the community is so important. In the same way that Daniel committed to the environment that he was in, we need to do that. The first thing that we're going to take from this passage is very simple. God equips us for what we need to do. The result for Daniel and his friends of keeping kosher was that God gave them the gifts and the talents that they needed to do the work. He gave them gifts of knowledge and wisdom, which meant that when it came to appointing the uber civil servants, it was Daniel and his friends who made the ultimate grade. God is going to give us the gifts and the talents that we need to operate in this world that has pushed him onto one side. And he's not just going to give us those gifts and talents so that we can do, as it were, obvious ministry. He's going to equip us to be part of this world so that we can almost, as it were, subtly influence it. He's going to help us become doctors and lawyers. He's going to help us, if we want him to carry on growing in the businesses that we work in. Not because we're suddenly going to become great evangelists there, though we might, but that we may be an influence there. So what can we do then? Well, firstly, we can choose to engage with our society. Don't withdraw. Don't withdraw from society. It becomes easier year by year, I think, just to simply say, I want nothing to do with this. Don't withdraw. Look for the good in everything, and only avoid that which is obviously ungodly. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. I haven't done that yet. I've come close.
But it's so important. For example, parents. Any parents here who look at the kind of music that their kids listen to and the TV that they watch? Hands up. The music that the kids listen to, the TV that they watch, and they think, ooh, I'm not sure about that. Stick your hand up. Okay, now, keep your hand up. Take your hand down only if you have never yourself watched something on TV after 9 o'clock when your kids have gone to bed that you wouldn't want them to watch. Yeah. I know it. I watch something on TV and I think that's really bad. That's really bad. And then I keep on watching it. Oh, it's horrible. Why is that on TV? Understand that we live in a non-Christian world. Choose the right battles to fight with the right people. Within Daniel, within himself, there seems to be a recognition that for him and the other Jewish princes, they are in Babylon for the long haul. This is not something that's going to finish in 2 years' time and then they get to go back to Jerusalem. He chooses a single specific point to stand on. He chooses a single point to stand on, but he does that having built up clear, strong relationships and having have a very specific marker. The battle is successful for Daniel, not just because he does the right thing. The battle is successful because he's doing it in front of people who he's built relationships with, who respect him as someone that they know as a friend. And finally, wait to see what God provides. And don't be afraid to use it. Daniel is eventually gifted, and he uses it, as we will see over the next few weeks. One might even argue, reading Daniel 1, that the example made by Daniel of engaging with his society, but making a stand on just this one thing, lays the foundation for the whole work of God's people in exile. It lays the foundation for Esther's rescue of the people. It lays the foundation eventually for the return from exile. I've gone on far too long. I'm getting angry looks from people who want to do baptisms and stuff like that. Go home. Read Daniel. Don't stop at chapter 1. Keep on reading it. See how Daniel and his friends engage with the pagan society that they are in. See how they build relationships. See how they choose where to stand. Learn. We are going to have to, as Christians, make stands in this country, as individuals and corporately, over the next few years and decades. When it happens, are we going to be making stands as a bunch of loony outsiders who nobody ever talks to? Oh, it's those crazy Christians again. Or are we going to make those stands as valued friends and colleagues, as respected people in the country who people know us to be, who then they find out actually there are certain things that we simply cannot do? Daniel makes a choice. He risks everything, and God gives him everything. What are we going to do?